This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After becoming one of the most controversial pop icons of her generation, selling close to 200 million albums around the world, Madonna is now writing children's books. We're going to talk with her about her children's books and how she created her stage persona, but let's start with her first number one hit recorded in 1984. Madonna's latest album, American Life, was released in April of 2003. Since then, she's published four children's books in a projected series of five. Each is set in a different time and place and is drawn by different artists. The new book is called The Adventures of Abdi. The readership of her children's books includes her own two children. Well, Madonna, welcome to Fresh Air. Why don't you read the opening of your new children's book?
Okay. Long ago, in a land far away from the one we know, where sand and mountain stretched as far as the eye could see, and snake charmers wandered the streets, there lived a little boy named Abdi. Abdi was an orphan who was looked after by an old family friend named Eli, who owned a jewelry shop. Eli was no ordinary jeweler. People came to him from near and far to have their precious gems made into exquisite necklaces, rings, and bracelets. It was said that Eli possessed magical powers, since every person who purchased or was given one of his unique ornaments was blessed with good fortune.
The story goes on to be a lot about magic, about certainty, mm-hmm. and about a belief that whatever happens to you is the best thing that could happen.
Yes.
And one of the lines in the book is, without certainty, we can accomplish nothing.
Exactly.
And that's a line that has a lot of different interpretations, because it's important to be certain and confident. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, certainty can really be a very misleading thing, because you could be certain and you can be wrong.
Yes, but that's okay too. It's okay to be wrong. I mean, that's how we learn our mistakes. I mean, you can, you know, it's better to be on the fast road to hell than the slow road to hell, because it'll just take you forever to get there. And it implies, you know, certainty implies that, you know, you have made a commitment. And if you realize it's best to get to the idea that you've made a mistake quicker rather than slower. So I disagree with you.
Your first children's book, The English Roses, was about mm-hmm. a group of girls who shun another girl out of jealousy, because this other mm-hmm. girl, she's beautiful, she's virtuous, mm-hmm. and they're so envious, mm-hmm. they kind of share this dream that they've traded places with her, mm-hmm. and they learn that her life is actually really difficult. She has no mother, she has mm-hmm. to cook and clean, mm-hmm. she's almost treated like Cinderella on a bad
right.
day.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting that you made the girl who's left out because she's beautiful, as opposed mm-hmm. to left out because she's the ugly duckling.
Right. Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a lesson about how we always judge people by how they look. And we are equally as judgmental of people who are good looking as we are of people who aren't good looking. I mean, you know, how many times have people made the assumption that someone's really beautiful is stupid? You know what I mean? Or someone who is really beautiful has everything that they could ever want in life, and they must be the happiest person on the planet. I mean, people always equate beauty with perfection, and it you know, that couldn't be more wrong. That's really the message of that book, that we cannot judge people by what we see.
Do you feel that judgment was ever made against you?
It continues to be made against me, but I think it, you know, I think we all suffer it. It's not just made against me because I happen to be a public figure or famous. I think each and every one of us are tricked by our eyes. And I misjudge people by what I see as well.
How did you start writing children's books?
I started writing children's books because I had a teacher, I still have a teacher that I study Kabbalah with, and he had suggested to me that I write them. I think one of the things that I think I was sitting around complaining about something, to tell you the truth, and he said, you know what? You really don't have any business complaining about anything. Why don't you do something to help other people? And I said, you know what? You're right. That's really embarrassing. And I'd learned so much from studying with him over the years that I decided what I would do was write children's books and encompass the things that I had learned in stories for children, stories that children could understand. And because I have children, I could see very clearly that, you know, bad behavior and bad habits start when people are really young. So why not like try to like nip that in the bud when you can?
Now, your music has been in part about defying convention and, mm-hmm. and also about being very overtly sexual. Do you feel like you have become a different person, or that you're just drawing on two different parts of yourself now, the more like sexual part and also the kind of children's author parent part? Are those two separate parts of you, or do you feel like you're moving beyond the earlier?
I think that I've changed and uh-huh. evolved as a person. I'm, you know, when I was exploring sexuality and being sexually provocative, it was a very different time in my life. I wasn't married. I didn't have children. But beyond that, I really wasn't thinking about I wasn't thinking in the big picture, you know, whether what I was doing was actually, you know, meaningful or helping people. And maybe in the long run, it was helpful, but I think my desires came from a much more selfish point of view. And I think that I have a different opinion about life and what my job is as an entertainer. And that is something that is a bit more helpful to humanity. And at this point in my life, I'm more interested in, you know, coming up with solutions to problems rather than just provoking people for the sake of provoking them. That is not to say that I have become a righteous person, that I don't make mistakes. And, you know, I'm still, you know, I consider myself a sexual person. I'm just not, you know, I'm not working out like my confusion about my own sexuality publicly. And that's really what it boils down to. And I sort of have a different point of view about sex now than I did then. So, It's kind of everything, and it's kind of everything that you mentioned. You know, that was an old part of me, and I am, you know, I'm looking at my place in the world differently than I was 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Do you feel like your earlier music was about working out publicly your confusion about your own sexuality?
Some of my music was. I mean, not all of my music. Some of my music was. Some of my interviews were. The photo shoots I did. The book that I released. I mean, there's, you know, it kind of came out in everything that I was doing. And it didn't start off that way. That's certainly not how I started off, but it was my blue period.
what do you think of as the confusion? What do you think the confusion was about? Was it a straight or gay kind of confusion, or?
Oh, no, not at all. Uh-huh. I think I was raised in a very kind of conservative household where, you know, the idea was, you know, my father didn't go around telling my brothers they had to be virgins when they were married. He just told my sisters and me. And I kept thinking, well, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture. How come my brothers don't have to restrict themselves sexually, but we do? And there seemed to be a lot of, you know, restrictions put on women when it came to sexuality and none on men. And as I, you know, became more famous and started to see what people were writing about me, I noticed that people were writing and making comments about the way I looked, and then I would compare it to, you know, what they would write about men, and they wouldn't comment so much about the way a man looked. And then I also noticed that if you were perceived as being sexy or attractive or pretty, you pretty much were sort of, the idea that you had something of value to say was also taken away from you. And so I think I kind of got angry and reactive about all of that. And I decided to like sort of take it all the way over the edge and say, well, wait a minute, that's not true. You can actually be very sexual and very intelligent at the same time. And watch this, and here I'm going to do it. And not only that, but, you know, there's more to life than, you know, the male, you know, turning a female into an object, a sex object, I'm going to turn myself into a sex object. You know what I mean? I was just playing with convention and sexuality and trying to see what the boundaries were. And, you know, I was kind of trying to work it out, in, not only in my own head, but trying to understand, you know, why men and women were perceived differently and treated differently, only to realize and understand now that, in fact, women and men are different, and that's all there is to it. You know, male energy and female energy is indeed very different, and that is why, on a very primal level, we have the reactions that we do. So it was a sociological study for me.
Were you ever shy or self-conscious about your body?
Yes, I continue to be shy and self-conscious about my body. That is like that's the paradox of me.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought you were going to say, are you kidding? Of course not.
No. Right. Well, no, I think I've always felt awkward about my body since I was a child. I was kind of chubby and overweight when I was younger. And, you know, I wasn't popular at all. I'd never had a boyfriend in high school. Well, I did have one boyfriend, but he was like the weirdest person in the school. And I think when I even became, when I became a dancer, I started to lose weight and get thin, you know, and then I felt like people started to notice me and like me more because I was thin, which is just hideous and ridiculous. But that is the way we are. And then I stopped dancing, and then I kind of got chubby again, and that's when I was a performer, and everybody kept making remarks about how chubby I was, and that sort of irritated me. And so I felt like my body was always being, you know, criticized or pointed out, and I felt actually very self-conscious all my life about it. And I think part of my own kind of private and public sexual revolution was me saying, okay, I don't want to be ashamed of my body. So, but I still struggle with it. And, you know, after you have two children, you become like obsessed with like not having a flat stomach anymore.
My guest is Madonna. She's just published her fourth children's book. It's called The Adventures of Abdi. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Madonna, and she's just published her fourth children's book, and it's called The Adventures of Abdi. You were brought up in the church.
Yes, I was. Roman Catholic.
And did you ever feel that in your soul? I mean, did you ever really respond to the church, or were you always just like performing a responsibility by going?
But it's hard to say, did you ever feel, because as you know, as in the Roman Catholic Church doesn't really explain anything to you. You are essentially taught to do things because that's what the Pope decrees, and that's what tradition will have you do, and that's what your family's been doing over the ages, and that's what you do. And so you can't help but look at it any other way then it's a responsibility, because it doesn't seem to be founded in anything except, you know, this is the way my family used to do it, or this is the way my ancestors used to do it. And it's only natural to gravitate away from that if people don't have answers. I mean, my father used to say to me all the time, you know, you can't wear pants to church. And I'd say, why? And he'd say, because you can't, because I said so, because it isn't done. And those answers were just never good enough for me. And I find that that's true of religion in general, that no one really seems to have answers. And that's really why I moved away from the church, and that's really why I studied Kabbalah, because there are answers. And in fact, you know, a Kabbalist learns from day one that you have to ask why, and you must ask any question that you have and not stop asking until you get answers. So,
was there a sense of power that you got by using some religious some Catholic iconography in your work and subverting it? I mean, did that have a lot of power because you were brought up in the church?
I think so. I think, you know, the crucifix is a symbol of suffering and being a martyr, and maybe somehow I subconsciously thought of myself as that. So I think that was part of it. And also just the idea that I was being sexually provocative and using, you know, a symbol of moral repression, you know, at the same time. It was just, you know, it was a very provocative combination. And I knew it would piss my father off. So that's the main thing.
That was a good thing.
Yeah. Well, That's what you got to do when you have eight brothers and sisters. Got to do really provocative things to get your dad's attention.
Now, you mentioned before that, you know, as I think all your fans know, that you're studying Kabbalah now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you said that, I think through that you've learned a little bit about differences between male and female energy or between mm-hmm. men and women. What have you mm-hmm. come to see as essential differences between men and women now?
I think that women are naturally, they're naturally more giving, they're naturally more generous. And they have the ability to see things in a prophetic way, and whereas men can't. Men are much more informed by the mechanics of things and by the surface of things. They're much more visually oriented. You know, I mean, I don't want to get into like, oh, women are better at this or men are better at that, because men are very good at some things that women aren't, and men and women are, and vice versa. I do think that because women are naturally more compassionate and more generous, you know, we have a tendency to want to resolve conflicts without fighting and without confrontation, whereas men aren't.
Ergo
the war in Iraq. So.
Is studying Kabbalah a sign that you've become Jewish, or is it just study
please,
of Kabbalah?
Don't make me sick. I'm never going to be Jewish, and I hate that phrase. And I have not converted to Judaism, and I'm not a member of any religion. I just makes me sick when people say that all the time, because nobody actually bothers to do the research to find out what it actually is. You know, it's not religion. It is, you know, it's a belief system that's been around, a philosophy or a body of wisdom that's been around for thousands of years, and it predates religion. And in fact, a lot of religious beliefs get their ideas from the Kabbalah, but a lot of scientists get their ideas from the Kabbalah, like Isaac Newton, and Greek philosophers like Plato, and Thales, or Thales, I don't know how you pronounce his name, they're, you know, I think that science, religion, philosophy, even Shakespeare has at one time or another drawn from the wisdom of Kabbalah. Even Jung, if you study Jung, he studied Kabbalah for a very long time. It's actually quite fascinating and amazing to realize how many people were actually studying Kabbalah over the last 1,000 years or couple of 1,000 years. And we also believe that Jesus was a Kabbalist. So, because Jesus' message is essentially the message of the Kabbalah, love your neighbor as yourself, is see the world as unified, see the world as one. And that's what a Kabbalist believes. And so your whole life and all the decisions that you make and all your actions are meant to bring you closer to that idea, or promote that idea through your work, that we are, you know, there is no fragmentation. Religion fragments people, and Kabbalah unifies people.
So just to clarify, so that our listeners understand, when I asked you if this meant that you were turning to Judaism, and you said that makes me sick, you didn't mean that Judaism of all the religions makes you sick.
No.
You mean the idea of turning to any religion.
I don't want to convert to any religion.
I just wanted to make sure that was clear to.
No, I mean, no, but the reason it makes me sick is because I hear a lot of people in rabbis and religious Jews, I hear a lot of people say, oh, you know, she shouldn't be dabbling in the Kabbalah, or they think that I've converted to Judaism, or this, that, and the other, they couldn't be further away from the truth. I don't, you know, I was raised a Catholic, and I've had enough of religion, and, you know, I don't want to judge other people for their religious beliefs, you know, whatever works for you, but as long as it is working for you. Once you join a group that says, you know, we're better than you because we're in this group, then that's something I'm not interested in. Unfortunately, most people that are part of a religious group do think that. They think if you're not Christian, that you're going to go to hell when you die. Or if you're not Jewish and you're not the chosen person, you know, part of the chosen people, quote unquote, then, you know, tough luck for you. I mean, I don't, Kabbalists, and I include myself in that group of people do not look at the world in that fragmented sort of way. And I think it's rather impossible to say, I'm religious, but I want to unite the world. It's a major paradox.
Madonna has just published her fourth children's book. It's called The Adventures of Abdi. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Madonna. She's just written the fourth in a series of five children's books. The latest is called The Adventures of Abdi. You're writing children's books now. What books or movies or music did you really care about when you were the age of your daughter, which is, what, eight? She's around eight now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't really see movies when I was eight. I had a very big appetite for reading, and that was really my escape. And I mean, I read all kinds of books. Do you want to know, like, which particular books?
Sure, or, yeah.
I mean, I loved the C.S. Lewis, The Chronicles of Narnia, Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, Charlotte's Web, The Little Prince, just escaping to other worlds, you know. But I love to read, always.
What about music? When did that enter your life in a meaningful way?
Music entered my life in a meaningful way when I started dancing, when I started studying ballet, and that was classical music. So that was really what I got, you know, interested in first, classical music, Mozart and Chopin and Bach and Vivaldi and so on and so forth. And I wasn't really interested in pop music until I moved to New York, to tell you the truth. I mean, I did, I won't lie, I did see a few concerts when I was in high school before I moved to New York. I saw David Bowie, and that was a kind of a life-changing experience for me. I just thought he was the most amazing creature I'd ever seen. And I thought, you know, he really pushed the envelope, and he was confusing to me because I couldn't understand. He was so androgynous, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. his music was amazing. And so that made a huge impact on me. But I didn't really buy records when I was little. I just didn't do it. And I didn't really think about becoming a singer or writing music or doing what I do now until I quit dancing.
Now, your music first caught on as dance music in the clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going to the clubs to dance?
Yep, that's the only thing I did. I never drank, took drugs, or anything. I just would go to a disco and dance for 6 hours, like some weird whirling dervish.
And did you dance dances that you would just kind of improvise, or
yeah.
were there certain dances of the time that you were doing?
No, I just improvised, and nobody danced with me because I think I was a bit too wild.
So you just danced yourself on the floor?
Yeah, it was a little bit pathetic. I just went out and danced. Sometimes girls threw drinks on me and stuff, I remember.
Why?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. Mean girls and discos. You know, see, it just sort of kept repeating that theme. I had mean girls picking on me in school, and then, you know.
The early work that you did as a performer was the kind of thing that some parents would have liked to hide from their children because it was so overtly unconventional and sexual.
Mm-hmm.
Your children now are, what, eight and five?
Four.
Four.
Mm-hmm.
So do you ever feel like there's pop culture you need to hide from them?
Yes, I do, in fact.
What do you hide from them?
Well, my children don't watch TV, period.
Really?
Yeah. So that's it. They can watch films, but I choose the films. So, and yes, I do, to a certain extent, keep things from my children because look, I didn't grow up watching television, and
you didn't?
No.
You weren't allowed to?
Mm-mm. Because my father wanted us to use our imagination, and look, it really paid off, didn't it? So, I mean, that's the main reason they don't watch TV, because I want them to use their brains. I don't want them to sit in front of a box and get entertained and, like, turn into vegetables. So, they just read all the time.
And what are you going to do, like, when they get a little bit older and they start going to their friends' houses and watching TV there?
Well, I mean, you know, I can't stop that. But my daughter's pretty good about telling people she just doesn't watch TV. I mean, so she watches films, and she always asks me if she can watch the film she's going to watch. So, you know, I can't shield her from everything. But what I can do is try to stress what is important in life, and that is not the surface of things. And I figure the more I congratulate and encourage her to do things and that have to do with working on the inside of her and the way she, you know, acknowledge that the way she treats people is more important than the way she looks, that, you know, she will in time also not be affected by so much by the surface of things.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like in finding an image for yourself as a mother and a children's book author and Kabbalist that you've had to kind of figure out what the image is in the same way you had to maybe figure out the image when you became a pop star? In other words, did you have to construct it in a way?
Are you asking me if I've discovered who I am as I've explored my work? Is that did I find myself while going through the different phases of creativity and expressions?
Yeah, I guess I'm partially asking if you feel you found yourself, and if in finding yourself, this is who you found, or if you feel that there's an element of life that is theater, and that even who you are now has a theatrical element to it.
I think that art imitates life and life imitates art. And I think that, you know, very personal things have happened to me over the years, and I've chose to, you know, explore that in my work. And then I've had, you know, experiences in my work that somehow I've, you know, found resonating in my personal life. And I just think that there's like a reciprocation there. And I think that, you know, I can absolutely differentiate, you know, there's the me that, you know, goes to work and explores and works very hard and has lots of collaborations with lots of creative people. And I go on stage and I entertain 20,000 people, and then I go home. And then there's the me that makes the bed and washes the dishes and changes the diapers and, you know, does things that are actually, you know, quite simple and not associated at all with theater. So I see the things I do as my job, and I see my life with my family and my children and my friends as really the most important aspect of my life, but it also informs my job.
Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Madonna has just written her fourth children's book. It's called The Adventures of Abdi.